When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
People of the US, great news. The Formula One Circus is coming to Miami this weekend, and we've got everything you need to know on P1 with Matt and Tommy, the Formula One podcast from Stack. It doesn't matter if you're an F1 veteran or hardly watch a race. If you want a fun breakdown of the biggest stories from this weekend's race, we've got you covered. Join us for previews and reaction episodes from practice, qualifying, and the race itself, plus our full driver rankings podcast early next week. You'll be armed with enough info to make you look like a bona fide expert when the race rolls back around next year, or at least when you see your friends next week. Search P1 with Matt and Tommy in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now.
Hello and welcome to another episode of White Wine Question Time, Something from the Cellar, where we head into our rather fully stocked cellar to bring up a few delights from Christmases gone by for your listening pleasure. And this week, we're paying tribute to the man that currently sits, at the time of recording, at the Christmas number one, alongside his former bandmate, yeah, George Michael, who sadly left this world on Christmas Day, but always wanted to have a Christmas number one. It did it once a couple of years back, and it's about to do it again. As I record today, on Monday the 18th of December, it is at the top of the charts. Will it be there come Christmas Eve? I've got everything crossed, and so have these guys, because in this episode, we wanted to pay tribute to the man, the legend, that was George Michael. And first up are the king and queen of daytime TV, Richard and Judy. They remain TV stalwarts, and with legions of fans up and down the country, one of them, it turns out, was none other than George himself. And soon after the pair finally got chatting with George, well, he ended up being invited round at Richard's invitation for Sunday lunch. True story. Here they are telling us what happened when George Michael came for lunch.
For the purposes of research of this show, I sat and watched the other night and I thought, I'll just have a little 5 minutes with it, and I did the full show. I watched your last this morning because I was there with you on the day. Do you remember when George Michael phoned in?
Oh,
and savaged Paul O'Grady, which was really fun to watch.
With
George telling Denise Robertson that he was her biggest fan.
Well, I'll tell you a quick story about George Michael, who was in this room that we're sitting in now, our dining room. It was about 3 years before we left this morning and went to Channel 4, and it was about 2 weeks before Christmas, and Judy and I were launching, it was a Monday, we were launching that year's This Morning Christmas Appeal. It was some children's charity group. And so we had something that you would have done, a VT of some kind, you know.
And the
numbers to ring and the lines to call and, you know, a studio interview, big launch. Okay, that's the Christmas charity. And we came off air at 12:30 and our then editor was waiting for us in the corridor just outside the studio, hopping from one foot to the other with excitement. And she said, guess how much we've raised already for the charity? And we said, how much? She said, almost £100,000, which was unprecedented. And we said, what? How? She said, because we had one donation of £50,000 from one person. And we said, who from? She said, I can't tell you. I'm sworn to secrecy. So we basically grabbed her by the earlobes and said, who from? Tell us. And she said, well, it's George Michael. She said, George Michael watches the show. None of us knew this. George Michael watches the show all the time. He saw the thing and he's phoned in and he's pledged. And it's gone through the bank. It's in the bank now, £50,000. I said, well, we've got to call him and thank him. So they got his number for us. We came home here to our house. And that evening at about 6 o'clock, I'm in the other room and Judy's with me. And I'm a bit nervous, you know. We've met them all, but bloody hell, it's George Michael. So I dial his number. Yeah. And he used to live just around the corner in Highgate, about a mile away from here. So the phone rings, hello, and it's George Michael's voice. You know, oh my God, I'm talking to George Michael on the phone. So I said, George, it's Richard Madeley. I know you didn't want any of us to know, and we're off. And we have this conversation, and I thank him for that. And we get chatting, and we have a lovely little 5 or 10 minutes chat, and Judy's like earwigging behind me. She wouldn't make the call, she's too shy. And then I just heard myself saying, I said, you live in Highgate, don't you, just around the corner? He said, yeah. I said, well, we're in Hampstead. I said, I think we should say thank you to more than just a phone call. Do you think you could come around for, say, Sunday lunch at some time? He said, I can come around this Sunday. And Judy is going, no, this is too much. No, this is too much. And I'm saying, yeah, we can do this Sunday. Okay. And I gave him the address. And 1 o'clock, he said, and can I bring Kenny? And Kenny was his lovely American boyfriend at the time. And I said, yeah, sure, bring Kenny. Right, 1 o'clock Sunday. And I put the phone down and I turned around and Judy was standing on her head. I've never seen my wife do a handstand before, but she was standing on her head with her hands to sofa. Just couldn't believe that George fucking Michael was coming to our house for lunch. So flash forward a few days, and I'm in the kitchen because I do the cooking. I'm in the kitchen preparing whatever we're having, beef, I think it was, for Sunday duck. Lunch. Well, it was duck, that's right, it's roast duck. And it's bang on 1 o'clock, the doorbell goes, and I go to, you know, wipe my hands on my pinny and go to the door and open it, and there is George, it's like a beetle standing on your doorstep. There's George Michael with his shades and his leathers, and his stubble, and he looked great because he was about to go on tour, so he was on a diet and he was looking after himself. This is before he fell into serious drug use, and his very very gorgeous boyfriend Kenny behind him, and they come in, and it was a little bit, you know, at first, but after a few minutes, we got on, and they were here for hours, weren't they?
7 hours.
7 hours. Mm. I remember George coming into the kitchen just before I served up, in his shades and his leathers. George Michael's in my kitchen. And he said, I just want to say, no carbs, if you don't mind, no carbs. And I didn't know I've never heard that before. I didn't know what he meant. And I said, I don't understand. What? He said, no carbohydrates. He said, I'm going on tour in a couple of weeks and I'm still losing weight. So no potatoes, no parsnips, none of that. I'll just have the meat and the gravy and the greens. It's fine. So I gave him a plate with no carbs. And you know what? In 1 minute, he picked up his fork and he was nicking roasters off everybody else's plate. Nothing in his plate. But no, he was a lovely man.
Oh, and it
was
lovely.
He was lovely. He used to refer to his singing voice without pomposity as quote, my gift. And we knew what he meant because it was a gift. I mean, his voice was extraordinary.
It was.
And talking about how he had to guard it and look after it and, you know, not smoke and all that kind of stuff. And then, you know, we stayed friends for a few years, and then he just got lost in serious drug use and he withdrew from everybody. You couldn't talk to him. You couldn't help him. You couldn't grab him by the elbow and drag him back. He just disappeared into drug abuse and then, of course, died. And it was horrible. It was a real waste of a human being and of a musical genius and of a lovely man.
But he was a lovely man.
Next up, it's Welsh singer and presenter Aled Jones in another scarcely believable story. Here he is telling us about how he ended up on the same Rounders team as George Michael whilst performing as the wedding singer at Bob Geldof's marriage to Paula Yates. Yeah, pinch me.
What was it like being at school? Because, I mean, you said this in the documentary and you said it with a smile, but it can't have been easy at the time, that you were beaten up.
Yeah,
not school.
Not badly or anything like that. It was
after Top of the Pops.
Yeah, but also every time I went on the Wogan show, people would tease me, and he loved that, of course. You know, he absolutely loved the fact that, you know, I'd do his show and then I'd go back and people would be going, Terry Wogan, you know. But after you've heard people, you know, I've told you this before, they had the kids at school, the younger ones, had every break time they would sing My name is Ali Jones. I like to pick my nose. I do. I like to pick my bum, especially with my thumb. Ow. Okay, when you've heard that 5,000 times, you're like, yeah, whatever. You know, so, but also, do you know what happened? I found out very quickly who my really good friends were at school, and they didn't care what I did. And, you know, I still meet up with them occasionally now.
That's nice.
And, you know, we're still the same.
Yeah.
I hope, anyway.
I mean, when you look at the kind of places you were going to, from sort of singing in a cave in Israel doing Oh Holy Night, which for I mean, like the idea, Israel must have seemed otherworldly to you at that point after a lifetime in Bangor speaking part English, part Welsh.
Absolutely. And also around that time in Israel, it was dangerous.
Yeah.
You know, I remember we were going to be singing or miming Once in Royal David City. In the place, you know, and the morning we were going there, a bomb went off. And so, you know, that was pretty frightening, that first program from Israel. I've been back many times since, and it's a beautiful country. But yeah, that first one was just weird. But I suppose my mum and dad had never seen anything like it either. So they were making the most of it, and I was making the most of it. And so for 4 years, it didn't seem like, you know, it wasn't work. It was just
because,
like,
this was the most intense 4 years, because it was you were in a race against your voice breaking.
Yeah.
And in that time, talk to me about
those tablets worked a trick.
Don't, there'll be people Googling looking for them. You were the cut and thrust of it all. You know, you would go and perform for the Pope, then the Queen, Princess of Wales.
Yeah, that,
you know,
was
in a private recital. Tell me about those experiences. That's
surreal. Yeah. Surreal, really. And I, at the time, I didn't really take it in, I suppose. You know, I just remember in the Vatican, it was with Harry Secombe, who I loved, you know, a goon and all that business. And,
oh, my God,
but
yes.
Also a great singer. And I remember him and I, it was overnight we were filming there, and him and I had a competition as to who could sing the highest and the loudest and how long the reverb would last for in the Vatican. So we were belting out top Gs.
Just the two of you?
Just the two of us, yeah. And then we're going, 1, 2, 3, 4 seconds now. I can beat that.
Yeah. That's still quite something.
Yeah, and the Prince Charles one was just hilarious because he rang my dad at work.
No.
Yeah, and
shut up.
And my dad just put the phone down, and then the equerry rang and said, "Oh, that was Prince Charles. He's here now. Will you take the call?" And my dad's like in Anglesey Aluminium or whatever, going, "Hello, yes." And he said, "I love your son's voice. I'd love him to come down to Kensington Palace to sing for myself and Diana when's he free?" And my dad went, "Tomorrow, if you like." And a couple of days later, my mum and my pianist from Wales, Annette, and myself found ourselves sitting in Kensington Palace in the living room looking at photos of William and Harry as little babies. And then in came Charles, and came my mum a gin and tonic. And then Diana came in. She'd been swimming. And I sang for an hour. And then we talked for an hour. And I kicked the table like this, and a pint of water fell on the carpet. And I thought, oh, my God, they're going to send me to the tower. And Diana was lovely. She said, "Oh, the boys do it all the time. Don't worry," rubbing it in. Aww. Yeah, it was amazing.
What would you have been then, 13?
Yeah, 13, 14, something like that, yeah.
Extraordinary.
Yeah, that was the time I was most nervous, because we were just going to get a black cab there, keeping it real. And a friend of ours in London, who's a big businessman.
Surprised he didn't make you walk.
Yeah, probably my dad would have if he'd come down. He didn't come down because he had work. Isn't that great? I remember Charles asking my mum, going, "Why is your husband not here?" And she went, "Oh, he's got work." You know, sorry. You know, it's like a normal
future
thing.
King, yeah, of Queen of England.
Yeah, and he was like, "Nah, he's got work. He's got stuff to do, you know."
He's at the Aluminium
Club. Yeah, exactly.
I love it.
And this businessman said, "Oh, no, I'm going to take you there in style." And he had a Rolls Royce. And so we got into this Rolls Royce, and I couldn't open the door because I was so nervous, because it was just so surreal. Yeah. You know, I'm used to dealing with concert halls and thousands of people, but this was just two people. And so it's really exposing, but they were lovely. And in the end, we did a "What Would You Like to Hear?" And so for Diana, I sang some Beatles songs, and for Charles, did some Handel, and yeah, it was lovely.
They're like karaoke.
It was just like Welsh karaoke.
KP karaoke.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it was great. It was just like that.
Now, the other event that you performed at, again, which was an unlikely ask, I would imagine, was Bob Geldof and Paula Yates' wedding.
Yeah.
And the picture, I'm going to put this up on the White One Question Time feed. You've got to see this picture of you In a month. So, like, just talk me through who's in this photograph. There's obviously Bob and Paula.
Then we've got some of the Boomtown Rats. There's George Michael. There's some guys from Spandau Ballet. There's Midge Ure in a kilt. And then sitting on a throne is David Bowie. And I'm stood with my hands on David Bowie's shoulders.
You forgot Duran Duran.
And Duran Duran. Sorry. How could I forget Duran Duran?
Literally.
Because Simon and Bon was best man. And he came up to me, right? I can't believe I'm telling you all this. I don't know what it was like when you were a kid, okay? But in my school, we went through a period of wearing luminous socks.
Yeah!
And so you'd have one green luminous sock and one orange or pink, right?
Getting down the Sunday market.
I wore that for Bob and Paula's wedding. What was I thinking? Everyone's in like huge dinner jackets and stuff. And I remember Simon Le Bon coming up to me after the wedding and going, "Love your socks, man." And my mum kind of going, you know, I told him not to wear them. But what happened afterwards, the socks saved the day because Bob decided that he wanted to play baseball after the wedding. Everyone's in their tuxes, okay? And so there was a side, I think it was kind of Billy Connolly's team maybe against Bob's or something like that.
Yeah, Billy Connolly was there as
well. It was there, yeah. And so George Michael was on my team, I remember that, and Tony Hadley. And it was getting dusk, and so we couldn't see the ball. And Bob went, "Well, there's nothing happening for another hour. We should just carry on playing." And he goes,
"There's nothing happening on my wedding day."
Yeah, nothing happening before the do tonight. And so he went, "Al, get one of those socks off." And so I took off my luminous sock and wrapped it around the ball. And we carried on playing baseball so we could see. It's like so random. So random.
Wow.
Yeah. But they were so lovely to me.
I mean, that must have been like walking into the cover of Smash Hits magazine for a 13-year-old boy. As much as you're singing classical music and you're a soprano, you were still alive to pop music, right? You knew who they were.
Oh, that's all I listened to. And I was the kid who went around with his autograph book. Even Bob Geldof. I followed Spandau Ballet around, like...
At the wedding?
At the wedding. I'm so sorry. I've actually spoken to Tony about this, okay? And in the end, they were like, "Can you just, like, go away now?" Because I was just like, I love you guys. You know, oh, like singing their hits, you know, gold. And so they're like, "Oh, my God."
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
People of the US, great news. The Formula One Circus is coming to Miami this weekend, and we've got everything you need to know on P1 with Matt and Tommy, the Formula One podcast from Stack. It doesn't matter if you're an F1 veteran or hardly watch a race. If you want a fun breakdown of the biggest stories from this weekend's race, we've got you covered. Join us for previews and reaction episodes from practice, qualifying, and the race itself, plus our full driver rankings podcast early next week. You'll be armed with enough info to make you look like a bona fide expert when the race rolls back around next year, or at least when you see your friends next week. Search P1 with Matt and Tommy in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now.
Last but not least, the nicest couple in showbiz, the couple who were put together by the great man himself, George Michael, Shirley and Martin Kemp. Now, imagine meeting the girl of your dreams and finally organising your first date, only for her to turn up with George as her wingman, because that's exactly what happened to Martin Kemp when he went out on his first ever date with his now wife, Shirley. Shirley was, of course, not only a member of Wham, but was and remained, throughout his years, George Michael's very best friend. So here they are, picking up that story and so many more. Like, for example, the moment when George came to Shirley's aid decades later when Martin found himself in the midst of a health scare. Your first date came about, you went for a Mexican, am I right, in Covent Garden? But there wasn't just the two of you.
I get a bit mixed up here. I thought we did or was it Camden
Palace? No. Let's get this right. We went to Camden Palace. Our first date was arranged to go to Camden Palace. Shirley called me, right? It took about 3 weeks. And Shirley...
Oh, you played it cool.
I was so nervous.
And Shirley will tell you the story about calling me.
Yeah.
Right?
Okay, yeah. What, now? Okay, yeah. So... George kept saying, are you going to call? He was really excited about, because George was quite a big Spandau fan at the time. He's going, when are you going to call him? I was going, oh, I can't. Because in those days, you didn't have mobile phones. You called the house phone. Yeah. And it was always the mum or dad that answered it.
Yeah. And they read out the number.
Yeah, I read out the number, yeah. And we were at George's house, and his sister had a phone in her bedroom. And he grabbed me by the hand. He goes, right, I've got the number. Come on, I'm going to dial it. I was going, no. You know, and you go, no. I really do want to, but no. And he picked the phone and he dialed it and he handed it to me. My heart was in my throat. And then Martin's mum answered it. And I thought, I'm just, my sort of gets girls calling him all the time. She's going to say, no, he's not here. I said, hello, is Martin there? Who is it?
Oh, she never said that.
But it felt like that because I was so nervous. And then when Martin picked it up, then he went, oh, I'm so pleased you called me. And I just, and George is looking at his eyes and like head nodding. Yeah.
So
that was it. I'm shaking afterwards.
So we arranged a first date at the Camden Palace. Do you remember that place?
I love the Camden Palace.
Of course. What is it
now?
It's
a cool place. Tuesday night, Coco's now.
Coco's, right?
Yeah. I think it was Tuesday night.
And so we arranged to meet there. And I remember clearly walking down the pavement towards Camden Palace and on this first date. And as I get towards Shirley, I see her standing on the pavement outside, and Shirley had brought a wingman, which is not what you want, right, on your first date. You want to be on your own.
Who was your wingman?
George Michael. So George came with us on that day and spent all night standing there.
Like a spare part?
Really annoyed with me that I was snogging too much.
Yeah, well, I wanted some space.
Oh, my God, you didn't even come up for air. I just stood there. I felt such an idiot.
But you two kind of got it on.
Yeah. So
why do you think, because, I mean, he's one of your oldest friends, George.
Yeah.
Why do you think he was so gunning for you to go out with Martin? Did he have good vibes about it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he was like we were both each other's agony aunts. Mm. So, you know, he just thought, I know, because he knew I used to go on about Martin a lot. So, like anyone, do you know Martin Kent? You know? So I saw a picture of him in a magazine, and I used to say to George, I'm going to meet him one day. And then I even told George I'd marry him one day.
Did you?
That's another instinct, that feeling like...
Yeah.
And he just laughed. I went, I think I'm going to marry him one day. And I did feel that. I'm not just saying that.
Yeah.
It was an inner feeling that I think I'm going to marry him. And he just laughed.
So, did he?
There you go.
Yeah. Then he stopped laughing at all my instincts once I married him. Like, well, maybe she's right.
She's just like a witch.
Yeah.
I've always thought once you reach 27, you stay at 27 in your mind.
Oh, God, yeah.
And I think you've discovered everything about yourself by 27.
Well, I don't know about that. But, mentally, I haven't moved on.
That's me. I'm stuck at 27 in my head, you know. My body's 57, but my actual mental age is 27.
But I'm saying that, Martin, your head has been through an awful lot more than most.
Two brain tumours.
Exactly.
Yeah, jeez. Well, it got opened up a few times.
I mean, again, that's where your instincts kicked in, Shirley. When I was reading some old interviews with you, and you were just refusing to accept when you had your second tumour.
Mm.
And they were saying, God,
it was a tough time.
We're going to have to operate. She was like, hang on a minute. You found some world-beating doctor with one machine down the road from you.
Well, what was incredible was even before Martin was diagnosed with a brain tumour, I kept touching his head and said, I just think there's something about your head there's something, like they had this little bump and he went to the doctor. They said, I think it's a calcium growth. And then I said, I think it's getting a bit bigger. And I kept insisting, you need to go back to the doctor. And men are very bad at going to the doctor, what Martin is. You'll get there and go, I feel fine. Then come back to me going, I don't feel well. All right, get back to the doctor. I am not the doctor.
But I was I was doing a show called The Outer Limits in Canada. And I was playing this old professor that discovered a formula for everlasting life. And it all goes wrong because it was The Outer Limits, obviously. And... they were pulling on a bald cap to make me look like 200 years old, you know. And as they pulled it on, this lump on my head just was so pronounced. It looked like Ayers rock or something sticking out the top. And the calcium had just like doubled in a matter of weeks, you know, and it was huge. And so they sent me home from there straight away, and within hours, basically, they had me on the operating table for 8 hours, cutting the whole thing away. But when they cut the first one away, they found a second one that was sitting right inside, at the top of my spine, that was hiding. And that would have been the one that would have killed me if it wasn't for the first one. So, but I have to, I look at it as if it was the luckiest thing that has ever happened to me in my life, because it could quite easily, at the spin of a coin, it could have been cancer.
Yeah.
And it wasn't. It was a benign tumour that was cut out. So,
but on the second one, they were going to have to operate on you again. You'd already had to learn to walk again. And you'd temporarily lost feet. I mean, you'd been through hell.
That was the worst thing, because people, we didn't tell anyone about the second one. So obviously Martin had gone through so much, having, you know, his skull taken away, and, you know, just the bruising from that first operation took months for him to recover. And all I kept thinking was, oh, no, people were going to me, you must be so relieved now. And I'm thinking, you don't know, he's got a second one. So we didn't want to tell anyone that. And we didn't want, you know, it's just so... Well, sometimes when things are so frightening, you can't even talk about it, because you don't even want to put it out there for it to be true.
Well, you don't want to accept it yourself.
That's right, half of it. So,
but you never gave up on it, Shirley, because
I was furious, to be honest with you.
Yeah,
I was furious something. I thought, what's gone on? Why has Martin got this? He's such a... And I realised, okay, so it doesn't matter if he's been a good person or we've, you know... So then I spent the whole of the 90s going on this huge spiritual healing journey, trying to find... Because I sat there and I said to the professor, why has he got the brain tumour? He just looked at me and said, we don't know. And that made me really angry. I was really had a lot of anger. And I thought, you're a professor and you do not know why he's got this. So then I just went on this whole mission, got healers around the house. Martin was kind of like, okay, yeah, if you want... But
so
I just thought there had to be more of a reason. There can't just be, I don't know,
But I will say, you know, after the first one was cut out, the couple of years after that, when it was time to approach the second one that was hiding itself and growing at this super vast rate, you know, that I had to have taken out, Shirley and George phoned around the whole of the world.
Well, we just said looking for someone to
sort it
out. So what, you and George hit the phones?
Obviously said to him, what he said, they doesn't know why. And I said, I just can't accept this. And he says, I know. Okay, the best place is to go to America. So I've called back the professor. I'm going, right, we need to look into America. And then within a week or so, he said, actually, I found a Professor Black in America. And he suggests that this is what we're going to try. So we were all ready to sell our house, everything, whatever we had to do to go over to America and have treatment. I didn't care. And then he said, but the good thing is we can do this at Barts Hospital, which was just when we lived in London, around the corner from us. I'm thinking, why? Oh, how did this, you know? So it is that sometimes...
But if you hadn't demanded answers,
sometimes
you wouldn't have
to push, because I was angry. I was really angry that I don't believe this is nothing you can do about this.
But when I look back, I was such a man, because when the doctor was saying... We can't do anything about this one in the middle, this second one. He says, you know, we're going to have to cut through the middle of the brain, open it up. You're going to lose the use of your legs. You might lose your eyes and so on and so on. It was a disaster. It was a car crash. And he's saying, but we're going to have to get it out to save your life. So we're going to have to accept the terms. And Shirley's going, nope, we're not doing that. We're going to find someone else. I'm going, Shirley, shush. It's the doctor. Shush.
She's texting George going, keep calling America.
Yeah. And I'm going, Shirley, shush. He knows what he's talking about. I'll just go and get it done. And Shirley stopped him from doing that and took it on herself, and her and George found someone.
And I do advise anyone with a lot of kind of illnesses, look into it. Don't accept what someone's telling you.
Because actually, what you ended up having by way of treatment was almost like a chemotherapy. So there was
radiation.
So there was no surgery. They didn't
have surgery.
No, didn't have to open you up again.
Yeah,
which
stereotactic radiation I had, which was like two lasers coming together at one point in your brain that kind of burns that section out.
But you have to stay so still while it's happening, is that right?
Oh, yeah.
They
locked
you into the machine. And it was
must have been absolutely terrified.
Well, what happens is a couple of weeks before that, they take you into hospital, and they, in those days, I know it's different now because I've worked on a few of those machines now and I opened a few up in different hospitals. And in those days, they used to build this Perspex box that's fitted around your head, right?
Put, like, something
so the first one, like Shirley said, you know, I admitted and I said to everybody, okay, I've got this brain tumour, I've got to sort out. Second one, we were trying to keep quiet. So when it came around to doing the second one, they took me into Barts and they built this Perspex box around my head so they could lock it into the machine and get the laser to hit my brain in the right, absolutely right position. And it came to the day of the surgery itself when they're going to stick the lasers in. And they take me into Barts and they put the Perspex box on. And then they started to put me into a wheelchair and they're wheeling me out of Barts. And I'm thinking, I'm trying to keep this quiet. Hang on a second. And before I know it, they're wheeling me down the street with this in a wheelchair with this Perspex box around my head. And there's all people across the road going, it's Martin Kemp. Martin.
Imagine if they had phone videos then.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Boomerang.
You'd have gone viral.
But anyway, they locked me into the machine and they zapped me for 20 minutes. And within 6 months, it was dying. The tumour was dying.
It's a slow process.
And it disappeared.
But without the risk of that surgery, you also didn't run the risk of losing your legs,
exactly.
Your sight.
It's so much safer.
Your tenacity and your anger,
yeah.
Shirley,
yeah.
Was life-giving.
Because it wasn't... That process that they used on me wasn't something they'd ever tried before on benign tumours. They'd tried it on cancerous tumours, but not on benign, not on the type of tumour that I had. So it was
But communication is a key for so many things in life. If you just miss a little bit of information, it can change the whole course of your life.
So I took you out to dinner, didn't I, Shah, for doing that?
It is remarkable. And saying about your relationship again, that gave my relationship with Martin a whole other meaning for my gratitude. Just to think, my husband's still alive. You know, that was
doesn't
a whole
matter if
level.
He's annoying, he's alive.
So then I just was kind of so much easier on everything.
But you know, when you go through times like that, I think they either tear you apart or they bring you together. And for us, Shirley and I, we were lucky it brought us together.
Thank you so much for joining me this week for another trip to the cellar. If you'd like to hear any episodes in full, just search the guest names in our extensive back catalogue. You'll find over 300 episodes there. But if you want to cut to the chase, the guests that you've heard today, just search for them in the search bar are Shirley and Martin Kemp, Alid Jones, and Richard and Judy. From all of us here on the show, Merry Christmas. I'll see you soon.
White Wine Question Time is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
People of the US, great news. The Formula One Circus is coming to Miami this weekend, and we've got everything you need to know on P1 with Matt and Tommy, the Formula One podcast from Stack. It doesn't matter if you're an F1 veteran or hardly watch a race. If you want a fun breakdown of the biggest stories from this weekend's race, we've got you covered. Join us for previews and reaction episodes from practice, qualifying and the race itself, plus our full driver rankings podcast early next week. You'll be armed with enough info to make you look like a bona fide expert when the race rolls back around next year, or at least when you see your friends next week. Search P1 with Matt and Tommy in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now.